Welcome to the Gold Digger podcast series, a series that investigates the mysterious decline of Australian rugby union. It's a fan's journey into the void to pick up the pieces of Australian rugby union and find a path forward to fortune and glory. I'm your host and humble rugby servant, Matt Darrett, and welcome to episode 20. We've heard from a lot of people over the last 19 episodes, many who are well known to us, many who aren't. And today's guest is someone who completely exemplifies one of the buzzwords we keep hearing in the last couple of years, which is grassroots. He's someone from Western Sydney. He's someone from Penrith. And for the better part of the last decade, he's spent a lot of time devoting himself to the grassroots end of our game, working with a junior club and been involved in countless hours as a volunteer and a true rugby servant. His name is Adam Fletcher. He reached out to me on Facebook and we've been discussing some of the things that have been happening in the last few weeks. And of course, with what's going on in Western Sydney right now, with the pressures that it's under, and of course the talk about the Shoot Shield competition possibly shrinking, it seemed like a pretty apt time to invite him onto the podcast. Adam is the former president of the Penrith RSL Junior Rugby Club, which, as you'll hear, has junior teams from as young as under sixes. They conduct mini sevens tournaments annually, and it's a feeder club to the Penrith Emus, who are one of those clubs playing in the Shoot Shield competition, but are at most threat with these conditions being proposed by the seven Sydney Premier Grade clubs to participate in 2022. It's an important episode. It's about the challenges of setting up a rugby club in Australia. It's all about the competing market in Western Sydney from someone who is very much in that environment, and the way that support could perhaps go more into this area, an area that has a rich rugby history. We're always talking about the grassroots of Australian rugby, the beating heart and soul of our game. Well, this is about as close as it gets. So, Adam, thanks for joining me. Firstly, just to kick things off, do you mind just giving me a bit of an explanation of your background to rugby and I guess where you fit into the whole picture?
Yeah, sure. So my grandmother lived on the back of Sir Thomas Mitchell Reserve at Dundas. So outside her back gate was the football field where, you know, many Wallabies came from. My grandfather was a regular at the Vikings Rugby Club. I had an uncle that played. I had a cousin who played grade at Two Blues and Penrith. And despite living in Penrith, he travelled to Westfield Sports High. And because of the limited teams in our area, he actually played for Blacktown. They never had his age in the Penrith district. So I never actually played as a junior. I was into basketball and, you know, bits of other sports.
Was that lack of availability to play or just general interest in other sports? As in, were there no junior teams that you could have played in, or was it?
It just didn't seem prevalent. There wasn't the advertising for it, or there wasn't the knowledge of where rugby was, because when I moved to Penrith, I honestly didn't know about the Penrith Emus until maybe end of high school.
Yep.
Yeah. And that was only being inquisitive with my cousin playing at Parramatta. It was, why do you have to play there? And so I'm a teacher, so I went into teaching and I got involved in school sport, and I was obviously keen as a young teacher to be where all the other young teachers were going, away to Canberra, Wagga, looking after the representative sport for primary schools, and I was trying to help out with rugby league, which I had a little bit to do with, and then I got an option to help out with hockey. So I did hockey for a couple of years, and then I got asked, would I do rugby? Because no one wanted to do it. So I said, oh, I know a little bit, I'll give it a go. And that was more as a team manager role rather than a coach. And so, yeah, in charge of this team, and then soon realised I'm in charge of training sessions, and I'm on the looking, you know, I don't know if it was Google at the time, but searching up where to get help for this, because in other sports you would have the Eels or Panthers or someone from New South Wales basketball, New South Wales hockey available. And at the time, I think the AAU were looking after community rugby. And so I eventually was able to get...
What year are we talking?
Good question. Maybe...
The 90s?
I want to say, no, this is maybe 2007.
Right, okay.
So somewhere around there. Mm. Yeah, I was able to get someone eventually who came out. He told me it wasn't really their role to be doing this sort of thing. And I said, oh, okay, well, you know, can you put me in the direction of someone whose role it is? And, yeah, so obviously the next year I was a bit more prepared. I had that contact. And at the time I was playing Aussie rules, and I was a AFL school ambassador, and, you know, going to games, sort of not private boxes, but that have the corner of the feet of the ANZ or whatever, all catered, and they're giving away scarves and hats. And then, yeah.
I'm assuming at that point in time, you're a Sydney Swans fan.
Yeah.
Mate, I am a big Eagles supporter. So that 2005, 2006 was the peak of,
yeah,
of the Swans and Eagles rivalry. And it's interesting because I guess when the Greater West Giants came along, did you feel any obligation to switch allegiances?
No, not really. It sort of stayed put. I had a few mates who went that way, but yeah. You know, after being at the ticker tape parade and all that sort of stuff,
how could you leave?
Yeah, exactly.
That's fair enough. Mate, so it's interesting. So I guess sort of looking at, and so your current role is Penrith RSL Junior Rugby Club. Could you, I guess, just tell me a bit more about that club, how it was formed and what capacity it operates in today?
So I'm the ex-president now.
Okay.
I finished up last year, but I am the first life member, which is a nice hat to have. And still, wherever I can help out, just in terms of obviously appointing new committee members in the right direction or navigating some of the processes and things. Just going back a bit. So my son, I actually made an inquiry to a phone number I saw in the paper about rugby, because I've been doing school stuff for a little while and going away for periods of time, and my son asked me, could he play rugby? You know, he wanted to maybe be there when I was away. He probably didn't understand it, but I looked into it for minis rugby, and my first interaction calling someone about it was basically I was getting shouted down the phone by a very stressed individual who had done all this planning and about promotions and wasn't able to carry it through, and yeah, it didn't end very well. So we stuck with soccer for a little while. And then in the process of doing the role I was doing with schools, I started to learn about which junior clubs were out there, and I saw there was a Blue Mountains one. So I made an inquiry and realised they weren't too far up. They were just lapsed in at the bottom of the mountains, and we went up there for a few years. At the time, Hawkesbury was a Penrith club that's now a Parramatta club. I believe they were a Parramatta club some time ago and went back. It was just Blue Mountains and Raptors at Rudy Hill, which is now Western Raptors. And I just couldn't see how things all worked. And I still was trying to get an idea. And they started having like a rep program, and it wasn't under Penrith. It was like a Barbarians type thing. So they were trying to reestablish a junior district or have a representative pathway for junior players out here, which had fallen over some time ago, apparently. And so I joined the junior district committee when it was refounded in 2011. And in 2012, we started working, putting out some rep teams. And at the time, with council boundaries and things, I just couldn't see a direct link for the Emirs to have junior players. I couldn't see where volunteers would come from for the emus. And so it was a bit of a brainwave with a couple of other district people who also were at the other clubs and had the same view that we needed to start a club in Penrith Council, preferably at the ground, and to have a bit more of a direct pathway. So basically the skeleton or the bones of a, you know, of a team would move on to Colts from juniors. So we started in 2014. We had an under seven team, mixed of under eights, under sevens, under sixes, under fives, all playing non-contact tackle, which my daughter was a part of. My son continued playing up at Blue Mountains. And then later that year, I was approached by someone who wanted to do sevens and participate in girls sevens. So it was actually Matty Ashby, the current Australian sevens player's dad, Clinton. And we got to work on filling some girls teams to play in basically a spring sevens tournament, 7 weeks of sevens, term three. And in talking to him, he had some bright ideas about sevens as a Kiwi, knew that it was its own sport in its own right, and wanted to do some more things. So basically in the term four, we did a sevens tournament for under 12, under 14, under 16, under 18s, boys and girls. And it was quite successful. And, yeah, we had a lot of players participate in that are well-known names now. Batil Vet Welsh, obviously Matty Ashby, Joseph Sawali, and a number of others who are still up and coming. So, yeah, that was basically the start of it. From that, we got enough interest to field in the second year. And under 6, 7, 8s, under 10s, under 12s, under 14s. And so that got the ball rolling to basically where we were last year, even with COVID, that we had every age group up to 16s. So the club was in good health despite COVID, and that was time for me to move on.
Move on and hand the reins on. Yeah, but mate, so it's interesting that the sort of it's a massive catchment area for football in general. Obviously, Penrith Panthers, the rugby league, and I imagine all their feeder teams are going strong. I guess I kind of find it weird with some of the Shoot Shield clubs over here from all around Sydney that very few of them actually have junior teams, because, you know, I sort of grew up in WA where every club pretty much had from men's grades to Colts to women's, and then all the way down to, you know, under sixes or where it started. And you know, the Colts team I played in, I think this is partly why we did quite well. We made a final, unfortunately fell over. Mm. But when I look around and look at that Colts team, half of us had all played since under 12s together.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can't, and it didn't just sort of make it better in terms of the togetherness of the group. It just made you love the club a lot more. So it's sort of, it seems slightly I guess I get it, because Sydney's so complex with all various different areas, but it does seem a bit odd that, these premier clubs often don't have junior teams that would be sort of where you'd get guys and hopefully get guys for life. So the Penrith RSL does have an affiliation exclusively with the EMUs. That's basically the EMUs.
We're part of that junior district, with Raptors and Blue Mountains form their rep teams for the upcoming June long weekend.
Yeah. What's the catchment? How many other sort of clubs are in that catchment area for Penrith?
That's it. It's Western Raptors, which is basically the west side of Blacktown to about maybe St Mary's. Obviously, there's kids out of the area at times, but for Penrith RSL, ours is pretty much St Mary's up maybe to the river, ideally.
Right.
And then we overlap a bit with Raptors in Mount Druitt. Then Blue Mountains, a lot of kids, some of them are on this side of the river, some of them are just over the Nepean River, the Emu Plains, up the Blue Mountains. When my son played at Blue Mountains, we had a kid from Little Hartley, you know, Lithgow virtually. We had kids from Katoomba
all
through the mountains, you know, travelling an hour to training. So
So I was going to say, because you guys, aside from the clubs like Blue Mountains, which I guess are more subbies rugby clubs, you'll be the first Shoot Shield club that is on the, basically it's the first point for the country crowd coming in and playing.
Yeah, I've heard stories from some of the stalwarts in the past about there was a good connection with the country, but that's something that seems to have faded. Like recently, Blue Mountains Grammar School, which is right up the top of the mountains, they did a sevens comp, and it was basically getting all the guys who used to play for the high schools when all the high schools in the mountains played. Like a lot of old boys come and play in sevens. And that first year it was full. Like there were so many teams named after their old high school with players. And the motivation for that was because they had a new principal, and I think they were worried that they were going to can rugby. And I think they've got a bit of history. I think they were, you know, originally part of the King School.
And are you two Blues, Parramatta, or formerly Parramatta? They obviously share a bit of a border with you guys. So you might have people kind of going between the two, but also now Eastwood, who are relocating to Castle Hill and that area, presumably that's going to also now be an area where they may start attracting, you know, juniors and overlapping with your catchment area.
Definitely. it's that thing you hear about they're moving because, you know, basically the players in the area aren't rugby players is one thing I've heard. And so they want to move west. And so you can sort of see why the likes of Two Blues and Penrith are, you know, always have raised suspicions about how that works one way but not the other.
Let's sort of talk a bit more about that. And I want to touch on the Shoot Shield, but then also look back at the junior pathways. I suppose at the moment it's very much, and I think this raises its head every year, the sort of talk about reshuffling Shoot Shield. Mate, full disclosure, not that I'm from Sydney, but I played at Sydney University, so I've got some insight into the mindset of how that club operates and works, and that the resources that they have to attract players. I certainly, from memory, I remember we always had a few guys that would come and play fourth and fifth grade, and you chat to them and go, oh, where are you from? And, you know, there were quite a few that were from out west that
made
the trek into the city to play at Sydney Uni, or they'd relocated. I don't know whether there was money involved for some of those guys, unless they were sort of playing first, second grade, but there were certainly incentives. And I think there was probably an attraction to play at a club where every team was successful. And, you know, you probably, so I'm sort of, I have that perspective, but I have zero perspective from the other end. And I guess that's something I'd be interested in hearing from someone like yourself. At the moment, as it stands, the main clubs are all banding together to try and impose certain conditions that will have, you know, be very hard for clubs like Penrith Emus to meet in terms of, you know, financial turnover, fielding, was it four senior teams, three Colts teams? You know, where do you, obviously this is just a bit of a broken record, you've probably heard all this before, but what's your current sort of take on how that's playing out?
I sort of look at it and think, what are we trying to achieve? And I think if we're going down the line of having this open market where there's no feeling that the competition needs to be leveled, you know, as obviously it's maybe not a salary cap, but some people suggest a draft of players, and it's good, you know, those things are being discussed, and I think that's important that it's recognised that the competition isn't level. But I look at it and think, well, maybe the alternative is it is an open market and we just let these clubs do what they do. But I think that's very hard to marry up with keeping these clubs as districts and the role they play at, you know, at junior level or in development. If they were just like standalone franchises, you know, I guess similar to what the Melbourne clubs of the AFL, you know, they're all really close to each other, and so be it. It's not like there's a growth area and we need to go get into it. That's a different arm of what the code does. That's development. And if the way for the code to move forward is to have just these really strong entities which can offer opportunities. And I think people are always going to travel. So I don't know that we need to have these clubs as sort of outposts unless the support's going to be there for them to grow and to play a role in the development of the game.
Well, and I guess sort of one of the questions I sort of have, and I would ask this of pretty much anyone in any club, is what do you think the Shoot Shield should be? Because at the moment it's considered semi-professional because some clubs can pay players and offer other incentives and other clubs can't.
Yeah.
And, you know, having played for a club where there was a massive demand on you to train a lot more than 2 days a week, you know, the line got blurred pretty quickly as to is this professional, is this amateur? I don't quite know. And, you know, the problem is if you look at it as an outsider, as a competition, it's actually not a very good competition. You only have 3 or 4 teams that win it, so it's very predictable.
Yeah.
How can you get non-rugby people to buy into something when there's just a massive disparity in the clubs and the AFL, if you mention AFL, I think they appeared to recognise that a long time ago and made steps to even the playing field with their drafts and salary caps and you know, whatever else they did to balance it out. And, you know, if you're an AFL fan of any club, you've got a bit of hope because probably every 4 or 5 years your team's a decent chance of making a final. You know, maybe even going further. And it just strikes me as if they're going to try and make the Shoot Shield this brilliant club competition that they want to be, they have to figure out a way to level out the playing field. Otherwise, they're just never going to get anyone outside of Sydney rugby circles interested in the competition.
Yeah, and that's been one of my
questions. Is, I guess, is how do you level that playing field out in places like Penrith? You know, what can actually be done to help?
Yeah, I look at it and like I said before, coming into rugby is a bit of an unknown and not knowing how things work. I could only compare it to the sports that I was involved with. So, as a school ambassador, we ran, you know, 8-week programs on our school field after school. You know, on the second last one, it was a big day. The local club came down, gave out its flyers, and it was coordinated around weeks where they wanted to recruit players or in times in the season when they needed to recruit players. And it was just a great calendar. They just had everything there. And, you know, going to council meetings around green space and things like that, I was often there as a president of my club, but also the representative from the junior district. And, you know, other clubs from the bigger sports weren't there. It was just someone from the AFL or someone from Panthers who was there. And obviously trying to execute their long-term plans for their sport and, you know, had all the data around growth and where their players were going to come from and what their strategic plans were for the code in the area. And being in rugby, you know, you've got the Waratahs as the team that promotes the game. So if you want player visits, that's one thing. At the time when the Waratahs were separate from New South Wales rugby, you were still sort of going through them for that aspect, organising development officers to be there at your key times in the season. As competition level, you're going through the SJRU to for your needs as a club, basically. And then with the junior district, they control basically the minis competition. But for us, we're in a combined competition from under sixes to under nines with the two blues. And just the geography of that, there's clubs that are struggling. You've got Dundas Valley and Liverpool in a joint venture who are 25 Ks away from each other. And there's just a lot of those things that other codes just have the alignment so much better. They've got paid people in these roles. And for me, there's been someone on the junior district to, that's all my volunteer time. That's all after hours. And I'm trying to work with paid people who don't necessarily aren't available at those times after work. And so it's definitely like taxing as a volunteer, and obviously impacts on your work life, which I don't think people in other codes necessarily have those same issues in trying to grow the game, basically.
No, and this is, I guess, one of the things that I'm interested in, not just New South Wales, but places like Western Sydney, because, you know, part of my whole thing has been looking at the decline of the Wallabies and then obviously, you know, how that has impacted Australian rugby. And this is clearly where one of the key battle lines and the impact of all these, of this decline has been felt. You know, I think clubs like Penrith that have probably lost players over the last 15 or so years, it's probably happening to other clubs too, but they've either got resources or less of competition that Western Sydney has to get by. You know, but the question is, how do you overcome that? Because obviously, you know, New South Wales Rugby Union are stretched. Australian rugby is stretched. Development offices, unfortunately, are not plentiful. So how can the rugby community and will it require a sort of a, I don't know, some sort of a Western Sydney Rugby Alliance, some sort of a, you know.
Similar to what's going on in Southern Districts.
So, I mean, you know, do you think that's sort of something that would make a distinct change, or is it just going to be too hard a bridge to sort of bring all the different clubs and get everyone, as you said, aligned?
Yeah, I think, I know some of the clubs have really struggled since obviously the funding was cut and reduced then cut, which basically helped facilitate a general manager without having to dip into other funds. And I can see that's one side, keeping a premier club afloat, but almost like in the West, I think it needs to nearly be a community connector role, responsible for the growth of the game at grassroots level, making those links with local schools, which may be a Colts coordinator as well, wearing a second hat, who is the face of the club that goes into schools and is the one who's at the ground that when they turn up to do outside of school promotions or come down the register. I don't know if I explained it well before, but just the clunkiness and disjointedness of having a development officer spread across all of Western Sydney trying to do that for clubs. And like, there were many years where come rego time, I was trying to get the schools immediately surrounding our club involved in those programs which are meant to do that. But I think they were booked at Heathcote High School every year for the first few terms. And I don't know what junior clubs immediately close. I think it's Liverpool, and they've only just started fielding Sunday teams in those older age groups, which would come from high school. So, there's the strategy and the alignment has some way to go. And I'm not pointing the finger at anyone in any of those organisations for the work they've done. And like you said, with COVID and being obviously cash strapped, it is difficult to prioritise. And I'm not across what their immediate sort of needs are and actions are that need taken. But from my perspective, that's been one of the biggest frustrations in my time at Penrith.
One of the things that I've always considered, and I don't know whether there is a problem in policy or not with, say, Rugby Australia or formerly the ARU, but I know of at least a few cases where people, and then I'm talking former Wallabies and people who have actually done something in terms of set up their own programs, set up their own innovations around, you know, player development or clinics or whatever it might be, and have gone to the ARU or Rugby Australia and not had them endorse it or approve it because there was a dispute over ownership.
Yeah.
And I feel that there has been an issue that Rugby Australia, when I say Rugby Australia, I include the former ARU, have never quite understood how to take use of the volunteer movement they have at their disposal and integrate that into their business, because there's this reluctance to sort of let volunteers sometimes represent the ARU because they want people who are employed or whatever it might be. It's like, you know, and I'm just thinking of someone like my old man. If you said to my old man who's a volunteer, who's retired, who knows his rugby, you said, look, you're not an employee, but we'll make you an honorary member of the AA or Rugby Australia, and your job is to basically go and, you know, assist with clinics and development stuff, he'll do it for the love of it. He won't, he won't need to be paid to do it. But if it means he also has resources at his disposal, you know, maybe a little bit of kit to hand out and all that sort of stuff. That's what AFL and rugby league, and I'm sure they've got volunteers as well, but to me, that is what rugby in this country has never quite figured out how to best utilize, is the massive amount of people like you and like me who are willing to actually do a lot of stuff for nothing.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a question I've bounced off many people, is who is actually responsible for club creation in these growth areas? You know, extending down the new motorway from Penrith down to Campbelltown, huge, huge masses of housing. And I don't see anyone, unless it comes from a volunteer who lives in that area and who would be able to do it. And they can't do it on their own. They need to have the supports. So I was lucky. I had the supports in place of a development officer who was willing to give up his own time to assist with the creation of the club, because he had attempted it to do it in his role but had hit some roadblocks. So he was very on board with what we were trying to do. And
is the roadblocks typically, you know, I mean, I'm assuming for Rugby Australia, often the issue is that they have a remit that doesn't allow them to come in and, you know, but they, you know, a lot of the community development is left for the member unions, the New South Wales Rugby Union. So there's this sort of, you know, no one wants to step on each other's toes, but at the same time, it's like, well, if no one's getting something done, there should be no reason why. And look, and that's perhaps something I have to chat to a development officer and sort of get a bit more on their day-to-day pressures. But I guess from your perspective, what is the main benefits of a development officer, and how do they directly impact the operation of, say, a junior club?
I think it's changed a lot over the years. Like the guys who I sort of had contact with were ex players, some ex professional players, and so it was a bit more around their expertise with coaching. But coming into schools to really win kids over, I think kids are pretty savvy. As a teacher, I've always known that, but they know who's authentic. And to put a guy in front of them who has the runs on the board and is able to transfer that to coaching, I think that's a big thing to win some kids over. What I saw sort of later, I saw them trying to get people on the ground through universities, obviously studying various courses related to. And I think those people would obviously participate at clubs with Try Rugby and things like that. And I think it may have fell over a little bit there.
Yeah.
And in time, I know that New South Wales, for instance, have had a focus on education, so training up the community coaches to do the coaching. But I think there's also, and other sports are guilty of it, is what is a participant? There's been a big focus on funding around participant. So for me, I believe participants are kids who come down and register to play on the weekend. I see a focus move to a kid who does a 45-minute PE lesson for 6 weeks. That's been a frustration for me, that I think we need to have programs that align better with junior clubs to have kids converting that experience in schools to registrations. The experience for rugby for me has been at the clubs I've been involved in. And I think we sell ourselves short trying to replicate that at a school in a short lesson.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting you mentioned that. I know when I was looking at things like player numbers in Australia, and World Rugby put out in their annual report the player participation numbers of most countries. And it's always interesting. There's two columns. One is the registration numbers and the other is the participation numbers. A country like England has 2.5 million in their participation column.
Yeah.
But a lot less in the registration. Australia's the same. We have this sort of massive number of participation, but the registration numbers are less. And I've always wondered, well, what is that? Is that just literally a clinic that was done at a school and people attended, and that you know, and is there this sort of duking of the stats that goes on? Does anyone actually care about that, or is that used as a way to get more money? At the end of the day, I think you're exactly right. The people who are going to probably be lasting invested rugby people will typically go to a club and be involved in a club, especially even at schools, you know. And I think schools, while they're great, if guys play sort of for 4 or 5 years and then that's it, well, you know, that's a great shame. You know, you want to be seeing those guys spill into the various clubs. I suppose, you know, you mentioned him before, and I'm curious about Joseph Suaalii, the young teenager, and he's still a teenager. And for anyone who's listening who hasn't heard that name, because in New South Wales, certainly his name's been spoken about. He's, you know, a young kid who's now playing for the Sydney Roosters, but was in the junior, not the junior Wallabies, the under 18 team. He played rugby union at a GPS school and basically there was this sort of very public, and I feel for the kid because he probably didn't want all this exposure, but there was this very public sort of war between league and union about whether they could entice him to play for, you know, union. And obviously he's now, and it looks like he's on the, you know, the beginning of a prosperous league career. But yeah, I mean, you know, the classic case of the talent that is out there that is found, is discovered, is identified, developed, and then I guess gets to a point where he has to make a choice, and you know, depending on what code you barrack for, you hope he makes the right one.
He seems pretty settled at the moment.
Was he someone who you'd sort of seen, obviously, at the mini sevens competitions, but had you sort of been a bit more familiar with his development as a junior?
Not personally, not closely. It was basically his sister was playing in that tournament for us, and when we had the boys team, he came along for the second part. I was running around like a headless chook trying to convert all these sevens participants to winter. So unfortunately, I didn't actually catch a lot of them, and I would probably be reluctant to call him a Penrith RSL player, but I think we must have been pretty close to his initial beginnings in rugby, I'm sure.
And I think this is one thing that has struck me about, if you were working in a development role in some of these parts of Sydney, is you're right, to just blanket Western Sydney as the same area is completely flawed. Like, everyone's got its own specific demographic, you know, socioeconomic situation, population situation, influence of other codes. And so I do know that one big thing is that there's a lot of kids that play both league and union.
Yeah.
And while it can be good in terms of their development as players, in terms of the skills, obviously it gets to a point where, you know, guys then make a decision. How do you sort of find dealing with that? Say you've got players with your junior club who, you know, are playing league and are getting to the sort of age of 15, 16, and, you know, maybe they've got to make a decision.
I'd always known 16s was a critical age, and the first time we had 16s, it was my, because 16s is on the same day, league and union, and it was my big push that we needed to encourage the boys to focus on one. We knew we'd have a number of boys go down the school pathways for the 16s nationals, and One of the big things I always saw at Penrith was we didn't have boys who were physically ready, basically. So, we have a lot of big boys, but when you're making the jump from under 16s to Colts, which a lot of boys do, you will get broken down on technique by a lot of these older boys or boys who've played since under sixes. So we encourage the boys to choose and to spend time in the gym rather than trying to do field sessions every night for both codes. And we also combine that with going on a overseas tour to Samoa. And for a lot of the boys, that's their background. Not necessarily in that age, but obviously at the Penrith Emus. And it was it was a bit of a cultural thing as well, to for a lot of boys to understand that other side of the kids they play with. and yeah, just to open that window into their family and cultural life. So there could be a bit more understanding when they're in cults together.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, that sort of, you know, a big thing is the demographic is very much there's Polynesian and Melanesian, you know, families and communities in that area. And
yeah,
there was a comment someone made on social media when they were saying how there were decisions years ago made to say move junior matches to Sundays without considering the fact that a large percentage of those populations all attend church. And so,
yeah,
you know, kids going to church and then going to the game is not actually logistically as easy as most people think. And so there's all sorts of decisions that impact them.
It's one consideration I always had. I always had to check when White Sunday was, because I knew families needed to make changes around that to make games. Yeah. But
coming back to the motivations of guys when they get to the point of becoming an adult, is it as cut and dry as your 17-year-old, 18-year-old kid, you can go and play for a rugby union team and be part of a club and hopefully there's a, you know, carrot at the end of it if you're good enough to play grade and all that, or you go to a local league club where they could start by paying you $200 a game, and obviously, mate, it doesn't matter who you are, $200 when you're 17, 18 a week is great money.
Yeah, I know a number of boys doing significant travel from out west to play at clubs where they genuinely just want to be coached well. They want to be in a genuine rugby culture. They want other things away from rugby. They're looking for, yeah, you know, the friendship or to have, I don't know, opportunities, which may benefit them later. But I think I think for a lot of kids playing sport in our area, it is a way to move up socially or, you know, economically. It's one of the factors that I think is encouraged or pushed by family, that this is, you know, this is your ticket.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's no different to what we're seeing happen at the national level, where guys who are Wallabies are on the cusp of being Wallabies.
Yeah,
you know, they're plying their trade. They've worked super hard, but you're right. Yeah. They may have a family to feed, or they've got their own sort of future to think about. And to walk away from the chance of staying here and playing for the Wallabies and go overseas and earn three times as much money, it's just that the pool is too great, and I can't imagine how that's any. It's all relative, right? That's presumably for a kid playing suburban rugby, the chance to go across town and earn money or earn, you know, three or four times as much as what they could be getting is it's the same dynamic.
Yeah, I think, like you say, there's for Colts. I don't know what the answer is, because I know some of them can make money playing local league. I think it's obviously something that's needed maybe for first grade, but I don't know. You hear lots of things about some clubs not paying anything and other clubs paying, but...
Yeah, which I think brings us back to what we were saying about the Shield at least being a competition that perhaps defines itself very clearly and then allows clubs to realign how they run their business, whether they can then, you know, because no doubt, let's put this to you, if Shoot Shield decided it was professional and it made it very standard across the board that each club could, you know, monetize, set up a way to run itself commercially with sort of a professional first grade, you know, in your opinion, do you think, say, Penrith Emus could realign themselves, rebrand and try and come back as a professional club with guys that they can kind of obviously draw from in the area?
I think one of the big things I've noticed is that with the emphasis on schools being the nursery of rugby, that it's very hard to convince the powers that be that junior clubs is a real priority out here. So going back to talking about club creation and how we get more participants playing the game, I think there are certain issues which aren't the responsibility of rugby to change. I think one of the big factors out here is the closest rugby playing high school plays maybe a handful of games, and they're not in a meaningful competition. We have some boys travel from Southwest that go to St. Greg's, but if the clubs that are strong obviously have some of the best rugby playing schools in their immediate vicinity, and it doesn't matter where the kids live, they're going to gravitate to Colts with their schoolmates. Mm. So that's one of the immediate issues at a club like Penrith. Where do the players, where are they going to come from if we've got to focus on school being the place where rugby players come from and are developed?
I guess the one thing that I was sort of occurred to me was the decline in rugby at state schools and high schools, and how much of an impact that's had on clubs that don't have alignment with a school, either traditionally or informally.
As another example, the creation of sports high schools, they've got players travelling from everywhere. So a lot of Penrith boys may travel to Westfields or to Hill Sports, and they're just not within the immediate area of where Penrith's currently located. And I think, like you mentioned with Eastwood, they might be more inclined to head north rather than to Blues or for Penrith.
Mate, look, wrapping up, and I don't know what relevance this will have, but I'm just interested in success stories and case studies. And you look at Penrith Panthers now, the rugby league club, and you know, they've just selected the New South Wales Origin team, and there's seven Panthers in it, and two of them are debutants that have come through their academy. And obviously Penrith are doing, you know, I mean, they're undefeated this year, and they seem to just be playing really well. But again, everyone is talking about how they've basically developed a team. You know, what do you think they do well, and what are the lessons that could be learnt for rugby union in the area?
I think they've really addressed their pathways with how they get players from clubs to their door, and looking at how they manipulate the local competition, how they, you know, what they enforce, and how they get those teams. So, for instance, I know they enter the main competitions are every second age, but they enter the other ages in between in against other opposition, so they keep them together. I know they've obviously got the academy, nice big building at the back of the league's club, where they are well resourced. They've obviously got a lot of people thinking long term, big picture, and that's probably one of the things that I always think about with Penrith is and rugby in general, that we keep turning over these five-year plans. I enjoy reading them, but when you reflect back and think what was achieved, like, why can't we have a grander vision where we are the number one sport in less than 50 years' time? What's stopping us from doing that? When I look at St. Mary's Rugby League Club, we're originally a rugby union club who changed. And, I just see a lot of opportunities missed around what we could have achieved out here in the West for New South Wales rugby. You know, I'm sure there were huge tracts of land for sale out in around the airport where rugby could have based itself, where we could have had fields as far as the eye can see to have our state championships based there. You know, licensed clubs in these areas where we know they have huge turnover of money. Yeah, I just think there's a lot of opportunities which are going missing out in our area because we just don't have those alignments from the top down to the bottom. Yeah.
Well, mate, look, I'm, you know, going to continue chatting to people, I guess, and hearing a bit more about it. And I think obviously there's a moving story with what's going on with Shoot Shield. And it's not just about Shoot Shield. Obviously, Rugby Australia are going through a transition now. And you know, you hope part of that reset will involve a better strategy and then, you know, ultimately resources to run that strategy. And, you know, it has to involve Western Sydney. And I think everyone says that, but then what does it actually mean? You know, and I hope that sort of, you know, I think the recent the recent sort of review that I think is New South Wales Rugby did, where they were talking about it, and I think there was a sort of a strategy to move to Blacktown, Bankstown.
I think you might be right. Previously with Blacktown, you obviously being overseas can't see it, but if you got on Google Maps and have a look at where the M4 M7 is, and the base that Western Sydney Wanderers have built themselves at Rudy Hill in a national park, like, it is phenomenal. It is, I would say they must be around 16 soccer fields there now, plus their high performance building, whatever it is, and offices. And I know a few years ago, rugby were talking about that being their base, but obviously that shifted that thinking.
Yeah, and that's going to be the interesting thing is whether, you know, basically it will things just shrink back to working towards where all the current players are now, or will they take the gamble, take the plunge, and go, right, we need to be bold and go where the future lies. I guess lastly, your current role. I mean, do you sort of play with the club? Are you doing any coaching, or are you sort of just taking a break from rugby in general and just watching it?
So one of the things I noticed before I finished up as president was the trend of players coming from the southwest. We've just had the big update on the Northern Road, but it does take 20 minutes, or did take 20 minutes simply to come from Glenmore Park to Cranbrook, where we're based. So I have created a club at Ludnam. With COVID, it sort of changed how things were. So I am sort of the president for a club called Ludnam Lions, waiting on green space, waiting on sponsors to come back into play with recovering from COVID. The way I created Penrith RSL, I have said to myself I would not do it that way again. And I'm basically looking for the other stakeholders, including the unions above, to assist with that. So some time ago they were talking about what they were going to do for club creation, and they were going to supply the documents and policies and all those other things, which, you know, I was 3 years in and still didn't know some really important things around fair trading, for instance, as an association. I had to do that all on my own back. I knew nothing. And so I wouldn't necessarily come at it that way again. Luckily, I'm well resourced with how I did it. I've still got a lot of that sort of intellectual property I've kept. But, yeah, I really want to do it with that alignment from those who are responsible for the code to make sure it's done right and it's done well.
Well, mate, best of luck with that venture. And I suppose we'll just have to wait and see how things unfold. I'm certainly hoping that things like what they're talking about with Shoot Shield sort itself out in the right direction. It doesn't go the wrong way. And I think this is I think we're at a lot of critical crossroad moments in the game, and this is just one of many. And you kind of hope that they make the right decision. But mate, at the end of the day, as long as you can find a green space, find a group of people, have a ball, get a referee, all that sort of stuff, you can keep playing. And I think that's where at least the amateur game will continue to sort of survive despite what's happening at the top end.
It's funny what you said on one of the other podcasts. I bumped into the Penrith Emus club captain, who I know through a mutual friend, and he just relays his disappointment for how the game's gone. He was one of those guys who went on tour overseas, watched Australia play at Millennium Stadium, and he would be that guy who is at the Waratahs and, you know, watching the league on Sunday, as you had in one of your other podcasts. But he, with the way that he sees how things have unfolded with his old club, he just can't follow it. He's just embedded in subbies rugby, and he really, you know, doesn't have that passion for anything above that level.
Yeah, and I think that's it. And that, again, that's another thing that we just haven't addressed in this country, is how do you take what is rugby, people that love the game, but how you take that focus and spread it into the areas where you need to turn over the revenue, you know, get people buying the jerseys again and loving it and that buy-in, you know, and that's and look, yeah. Part of that could just be as simple as people winning again. But I think,
yeah,
you know, that what's been exposed is when the team loses, what do they fall back on? Where's the goodwill? And that's been, that sort of hasn't been there. And I think that's because of a number of factors, but also because of the lack of attention given to the so-called grassroots, which, you know, pretty much where most of us remain.
I am still very pro Penrith. But it's just hard. It's just, you know, it's out of their hands, unfortunately. There's so many factors that need to be addressed for their success. While people don't look through the lens that we have out here and how our perceptions of how success is important, it's just an ongoing struggle where the club has to perpetually defend itself and advocate that it's playing a role in rugby.
You know, hopefully this is going to be something that will be addressed and we start to see positive changes in, certainly in Penrith, but not just in, you know, there, but all around the state. Mate, appreciate it. All the best. I'll stay in touch. I'm sure we'll chat online and hopefully things will unfold over the year and we'll all be able to look to the future with a bit of hope.
Yeah. All right. Yeah,
great.
This is the Gold Digger podcast series, a spin-off from the new feature documentary film Gold Digger, The Search for Australian Rugby, which will be coming out very soon. Brought to you by me, director and host, Matt Durren, and sponsored by whoever wants to reach out and pay me to have their name up in lights. Music is by Makeup and Vanity Set, sourced from musicbed.com. Check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/golddiggerrugby. Follow us on Instagram for pretty pictures and Twitter for banal chatter. Till next time, keep on digging.